Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. John Lennon was cut down 32 years ago this week, the victim of a crazed fan who flew to New York from Hawaii and waited for the ex-Beatle outside his home at the Dakota, where Lennon and Yoko Ono were living a mostly quiet life with their young son. It was a cultural watershed, one of those moments that becomes a before and after fulcrum for those who remember exactly where they were when they heard of Mark David Chapman's awful deed. December 8, 1980, John Lennon's last day in his adopted hometown was a typical Manhattan day, full of traffic and noises and coincidences and ultimately unspeakable violence. More than three decades later, Chapman remains imprisoned, his parole hearings coming and going. Meanwhile, Lennon's influence on the world is still felt on a daily basis, though we must wonder what he could have accomplished in all the years he lost. Keith Elliott Greenberg is the author of December 8, 1980, The Day John Lennon Died, now out in paperback from Backbeat Books. Keith Elliott Greenberg, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thanks a lot, Ian. Glad to be here.
I wanted to start with your memories of that day. How did you find out what happened?
Well, I'm a lifetime New Yorker, and I always felt privileged that John Lennon chose to become a New Yorker as well. And when I say a New Yorker, I mean a New Yorker in the truest sense, because he truly embraced the city, as evidenced by the fact that Yoko is still here, even after experiencing the tragedy right in front of her eyes. I was in college at the time, but I lived at home still and commuted to college, and I was 21. And I was with a group of friends sitting in my friend's apartment. And my friend flicked on the news, as we often did back then. You didn't have 24-hour news. So at 11 o'clock, he put the news on. And it was already starting to break that John Lennon had been shot. And at first, we thought, okay, some crazy guy shot John Lennon. But it didn't really have the impact that John Lennon was going to die. And then as we watched the news, at a certain stage, they announced that John Lennon indeed was dead. And I remember just feeling floored by the news, because on a completely selfish level, I thought, wow, now the Beatles will never really reunite. It's never going to happen. And then the next couple of days are a blur, and the blur ends with me standing in Central Park in what is now Strawberry Fields among, over 100,000 other people in this moment of silence for John Lennon.
It was really striking to read just how much freedom fans had with John Lennon. One of them, an amateur photographer, had hung out at the Dakota long enough to become friends with him. So there wasn't this separation between Lennon and the neighborhood. And ultimately, that really ended up making Mark David Chapman's access to him tragically easy.
It's funny you say that, because I was at the Dakota recently with my daughter, who's 8 years old. I was showing her where John Lennon lived, and I pointed out where Mark David Chapman had been standing waiting for John Lennon. And she said, well, you can't stand over there, because now there's security over there, and you could never get that close to the residents of that building. These, I knew these girls in my neighborhood. I call them girls because they're, adult women now in their 50s. But I still refer to them as girls because I was a boy. They were girls. We grew up together. And two of them told me how they would come down to the Dakota all the time. It's like, okay, there's nothing to do today. It's Saturday. I don't want to go shopping. Let's get on the subway and see if we can run into John Lennon. And John Lennon would see them. He didn't know their names, but he'd go, oh, you two again, ha, 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 ha. And that was the relationship he had with his fans. And sadly, once John Lennon was killed, I don't think any celebrity of that stature ever felt that comfortable again.
You know, you mentioned the way you heard about it, and I was thinking about when Michael Jackson died a few years ago. It was an instant thing. The entire country knew about it. Cell phones were going off. There was texting and there was Twitter. And in this case, it really trickled out, and some people still didn't even know by the next morning.
Right. People didn't know about it till they were walking to work. And in New York City, we walked to the subway, and people were walking to work and saw the headlines at the newsstand. And that's when they found out that John Lennon had been killed. That was, the world in which we lived in 1980. And because there wasn't Facebook and there wasn't Twitter, that gathering at the Dakota in the hours after John Lennon was shot was completely organic and spontaneous. Nobody posted a message and said, hey, we're all gathering in front of John Lennon's home. People just felt this compulsion to go there. Since I wrote the book, I've had this conversation with a number of acquaintances, and I've heard different stories about people just showing up at the Dakota. One friend of mine already had children, and he said to his wife in Rhode Island, I have to go. He was watching Monday Night Football, heard about the death of John Lennon, and just decided to get in his car and drive down to New York. Another friend was in high school at the time, and she was doing a paper. And when it came over the radio that John Lennon was killed because she was listening to music, the next morning she put on her uniform to go to Catholic school and then just got on the bus, got on the subway, and went to the Dakota. Now, no one was saying, everybody go to the Dakota. They just showed up there. And that was as authentic as it gets, in my opinion.
So at this point, the Beatles had been kaput for 10 years, and John had spent the last five or so basically semi-retired. I mean, he had a lot of causes, but as far as recording, he was just breaking back into it. So why do you think that was such a meaningful event for so many people? He had been off the map for a while.
Well, but he wasn't off the map anymore. He had just he and Yoko had just put out the Double Fantasy album, and it was a very personal album, and it was an album explaining why he had dropped out of the entertainment business for 5 years, and he had to get off the merry-go-round. The song Watching the Wheels is about that. He had not done a very good job raising his older son, Julian. Beatlemania had taken him away. He had a very strained relationship, to say the least, with his biological father, and he wanted to change the patterns in his family, and for 5 years he stayed home and raised his youngest son, and by all accounts, that's why his youngest son is such a pleasant, I'm not going to call him a young man because he's not that young anymore, but such a pleasant person. Anyone who knows him will tell you that. So people felt they knew John Lennon, and they understood where he was at this point in his life. And then, of course, the music that he created as a Beatle and in the period immediately after the Beatles still resonated with people just as it does now. His message of, imagine if there was a world where everyone could live in peace. That's quite an aspiration to have. And when I was watching the recent violence in Gaza and in Syria, I thought, wow, wouldn't that be great if, you know, there really was a world like the world John Lennon imagined.
Okay, so you've taken us to the violent side. Mark David Chapman flew to New York and decided not to shoot John Lennon earlier and had to come back from Hawaii. Why that first time did he not follow through?
Well, Mark David Chapman, I believe, is truly mentally ill. And unlike many of these types of killers, he had the luxury of living with a very supportive wife. They were both born-again Christians, and I guess she was able to view his illness in Christian terms, and she looked at herself, I believe, as a charitable figure who wanted to give to him and help him live a stable life. I'm sure, like everybody else, he may have had a good side to him. He may have had a generous side to him. And he called his wife from New York and told her that he had come to New York to possibly kill John Lennon. And she said, get on the plane, come home. And he came home, and he was home for a couple of days. And then the demons in his head started up again. And he left once again, and this time, he followed through on this, you know, demented fantasy that he had.
As the years have gone by, the final interview John Lennon gave that afternoon, he ended up giving a three-hour interview along with Yoko to promote the new album, has taken on some real poignancy because of many of the offhanded comments he made. They ended up being viewed in a completely different light. What did we learn about him in that final interview?
You learn that this is a man who was at a very content phase of his life. He had taken himself out of the rock and roll world for 5 years. He'd raised his son, but the guy had music inside of him, and that music can't be repressed. And so there was enough music that he had written for another album, a follow-up to Double Fantasy. And at this point, he said, you know, he'll be done performing and recording music when he's dead and buried. And as he put it, I hope that's a long, long time from now. So this is a man who was enjoying life, appreciated life perhaps in a way he never appreciated it before. Now he had everything. He had the success and the creative fulfillment that comes from music, but he also had his family life. And so there was a lot for him to look forward to.
And as editorial pages around the world, as you write, condemned the U.S. for its culture of violence, allowing this horrible moment to take place, Yoko, as you say, remained in New York and still lives there, and Sean still lives there. What was it about New York that spoke so much to the Lennons?
Well, you know, when John Lennon was alive, he the very thing that killed him was the thing that invigorated him about the city. He could walk around New York City and he could interact with fans. He could interact with restaurant owners and connect with people. And, you know, when he was a Beatle, the Beatles really had to remove themselves and hide inside hotel rooms. And they didn't have any interaction with their fans. They'd be brought to their concerts in armored vehicles. And I guess Yoko got a lot of, fed off of that same type of energy. And I'm sure she also fed off of the sympathy that regular New Yorkers expressed to her whenever they ran into her in the street. And, you know, we all have our reasons for living in New York. Yoko's reasons were, you know, clearly bountiful. And she's remained here and remained a vibrant part of the city.
We've been speaking with Keith Elliott Greenberg, who is the author of December 8th, 1980, The Day John Lennon Died. The book is now available in paperback from Backbeat Books. Keith, a real pleasure to speak with you, and remember, a terrible day. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Ian. It's a pleasure being here.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.